the good people of the southern settlements to keep an eye out for his missing men, and the saints of Tocqueville realized they'd committed a serious mistake. Magnifying their blunder, Powell was a friend and vocal admirer of the Mormons, in sharp contrast to almost all other agents of the Gentile government in Washington. In a rising panic over what they'd done, the Tocqueville residents sent a bogus telegram to Apostle Erastus Snow, blaming the murders on their usual whipping boys, the Indians. 5 months later, these same saints killed the unfortunate fellow who had volunteered to carry out the executions, electing to sacrifice the executioner in order to stop the shedding of more blood, as Leaney's letter described it. Then, just as they had done in the wake of Mountain Meadows, the conspirators swore an oath to say nothing about the abominable deed to anyone. Larson theorized that this last victim, the presumed executioner, may have been a Mormon named Eli N. Pace. "I understand that Pace had three wives," says Dr. Larson, one of whom was the daughter of John D. Lee. "It seems possible that Pace killed Powell's men because he thought they were bounty hunters closing in on his father-in-law, who had a $5,000 reward on his head at the time." Adding weight to Larson's conjecture is the fact that Eli Pace died on January 29, 1870, under very mysterious circumstances. An inquest conducted by local Mormons determined that Pace had committed suicide, but his family took strenuous issue with this finding and demanded another, more rigorous investigation. The second inquest, presided over by Erastus Snow himself and weighed by a three-man jury that included Isaac Haight, corroborated the initial finding, to the surprise of absolutely nobody beyond Pace's immediate family. The matter was pronounced closed by the LDS Church and the local judiciary, which were one and the same. Larson's hypothesis that Dunn and the Howland brothers were killed by Mormons rather than Shivwits has been disparaged by most historians, as have all previous suggestions that the Indians weren't responsible. The majority view is based almost entirely on accounts by both Jacob Hamblin and Major John Wesley Powell that describe, with convincing detail, how the Shivwits freely confessed to murdering Powell's men. But such accounts, it turns out, should be taken with a large grain of salt. Hamblin enjoyed a reputation of unimpeachable integrity among the saints of southern Utah, who called him Honest Jake. The historical record plainly shows, however, that Hamblin had no compunction about lying for the Lord when he thought it would advance the goals of the kingdom of God. Indeed, the record also shows that Hamblin was quite willing to lie through his teeth simply to enrich himself. It's worth noting that John D. Lee had his own nicknames for Hamblin: Dirty Fingered Jake and the Fiend of Hell. In September 1857, immediately following the Mountain Meadows massacre, Hamblin orchestrated the shakedown and robbery of the William Duke's wagon train, among the first parties of emigrants to travel through southern Utah after the slaughter. Despite paying Mormon guides $1,815 to be escorted safely through the region, the Duke's party was attacked by a band of Paiutes, who let the emigrants escape to California but stole everything they had of any value, including more than 300 head of cattle. The emigrants noticed, moreover, that many of the marauding Indians had blue eyes, curly hair, and splotches of white skin at the corners of their eyes and behind their ears. In actuality, the thieves had been led by Mormons who had painted their faces to resemble Paiutes according to the instructions of Jacob Hamblin, which was, of course, the same ruse employed by the saints during the Mountain Meadows massacre and on numerous other occasions. The Paiutes were given a few of the stolen cattle as payment for their supporting role in the shakedown, but Hamblin kept the bulk of the plunder for himself, professing to be safeguarding the large and very valuable herd of livestock for the Duke's party until the emigrants were able to return to Utah and take possession of them. But when William Dukes called Hamblin's bluff and recruited a brave soul to reclaim the rustled cattle, Hamblin hid most of the animals in the mountains for 3 weeks, until the representative for the emigrants finally gave up in frustration and departed, nearly empty-handed. Although Hamblin was absent from the Mountain Meadow when the Fancher train was attacked, and thus did not directly participate in the massacre, after the fact he brazenly lied about what he knew about it in order to protect the LDS Church. Thus, when Hamblin reported that the Shivwits admitted to killing Major Powell's men in 1869, there is little reason to trust his word. John Wesley Powell, however, was also present when the Indians made their confession, and he corroborated Hamblin's version of the event. But did Powell understand what the Shivwits were saying, or was he simply parroting Hamblin's translation? In A River Running West, his excellent biography of Powell, Donald Worster, a distinguished professor at the University of Kansas, speculates that Powell was sufficiently fluent in the Numic dialect spoken by the southern Paiute tribes to have known whether Hamblin was translating accurately. If Hamblin fabricated the confession, Worster argues, he had to have done it without Powell suspecting, and that fabrication had to have been part of a well-orchestrated conspiracy directed from above. None of these hypotheses seem plausible. Wesley Larson, not surprisingly, begs to differ with Worster and the majority who share his view. A devout Mormon, Larson has no trouble believing that a fabrication could have been part of a well-orchestrated conspiracy directed from above. The saint's tenure in Utah is rife with such conspiracies. Moreover, Larson points out that Powell certainly wasn't fluent in the Paiute language. The Shi'vwit dialect was sufficiently different that they had trouble making themselves understood even to other tribes in the area. Powell would only have understood what Hamblin translated for him, which is, of course, why Hamblin was translating in the first place. And Powell's colorful retelling of his momentous parley with the Shi'vwits must itself be regarded with a healthy dose of skepticism. The best-selling book by Powell from which the account is drawn, The Exploration of the Colorado River and Its Canyons, is universally acknowledged to include numerous embellishments, as well as the omission of many pertinent events. In his book, Powell even conflates anecdotes drawn from three different visits to Utah territory. The original 1869 expedition, the 1870 excursion in which he met with the Shi'vwits, and an extended exploration of the Colorado Plateau conducted from 1871 through 1873. Striving for a more dramatic narrative, he shamelessly presents events from 1872 as having occurred in 1870. In his fascinating book, Colorado River Controversies, the surveyor, engineer, and amateur historian Robert Brewster Stanton, 1844 to 1922, wrote, "When I first became acquainted with Major Powell's report giving his account of that first exploration, it was to me the most fascinating story I had ever read. Even after completing the railway survey and finding many of his descriptions of the conditions of the canyon and the river, to say the least, misleading, I found the narrative of the adventures of the party as beautiful and as fascinating as ever. With all this in mind, however, I nevertheless experienced one of the greatest regrets of my life when I learned in later years that a large part of the story credited to the exploration party of 1869 was taken from the experiences and notes of the expedition of 1871 and 1872. When, in 1889, Stanton interviewed Jack Sumner, Sumner told Stanton, with a trace of bitterness in his voice, "There's lots in that book besides the truth," and turned away. Perhaps the greatest reason to doubt the accepted version of what happened to Powell's men is that it simply doesn't stand the test of common sense. Both Mormonee and Maricats were typically quick to avenge Indian depredations, yet nobody ever attempted to punish the Shi'vwits who'd allegedly killed Dunn and the Howlands. No real effort was even made to recover their valuable guns, scientific instruments, or papers from the Indians. This despite the fact that the telegram sent by an anonymous saint on September 7, 1869, which first reported the murders, also stated that two of the Shi'vwits who killed the men are in the Washington Indian camp with two of the guns. The Washington Indian camp was less than 10 miles from St. George, but no saint ever made the short trip up the hill to arrest the alleged perpetrators, or even to ask them where they had left the bodies of Powell's men. Curiously, the telegram included no mention of who had composed it or from where it was sent. Larson points out that it very well could have originated in Tocqueville, where a telegraph office was situated in the same ward house in which the murders were alleged to have occurred. It seems strange, he adds, that after Apostle Snow received the telegram, none of the locals tried to bring the Indians to justice. I've never heard of Indians being left alone after committing a deed like that during this period of Utah's history. 3 years earlier, for example, two settlers were killed by Paiutes near Pipe Spring. Just 8 days after this attack, a group of Mormons rode from St. George onto the Arizona Strip and executed 7 Paiutes in retaliation, even though it turned out that none of the 7 had been party to the murder of the settlers. It also strains belief that 3 Shi'vwits would have been able to surprise and kill 3 seasoned, well-armed mountain men. The Shi'vwit tribe had no firearms of any kind. They were known to be a docile, dirt-poor band of seed-gatherers and bug-eaters. Dunn and the Howland brothers, on the other hand, had two rifles and a shotgun, and were ever alert to the possibility of an ambush after years of tangling with Indians. Before joining Powell's expedition, William Dunn had been wounded 4 times by Comanches, and as a consequence was especially wary of further attacks. While the evidence may not be conclusive that the 3 men who disappeared from Powell's expedition were murdered by the inhabitants of Tokerville, credible evidence that Powell's men were shot full of arrows by Shivwitz, as Hamblin reported, is in even shorter supply. It is thus hard to countenance scholars, and their numbers are legion, who blithely assert that Indians killed William Dunn, Oromel Howland, and Seneca Howland, especially given the Mormons' unfortunate and thoroughly documented history of framing Indians for crimes that were actually committed by Latter-day Saints. As for the Shivwits, 2 decades after their parley with Powell and Hamblin, the Saints forced the Indians to leave their vast ancestral homeland on the Arizona Strip because the range was wanted for grazing Mormon cattle. The Mormons relocated the Shivwits onto a minuscule reservation on the outskirts of St. George, barely 6 miles across by 6 miles long. In the years following the Mountain Meadows Massacre, most of the culpable Saints fled to remote desert settlements in order to elude their Gentile pursuers. But not John D. Lee, who had become the wealthiest man in southern Utah during this period and was loath to abandon the comforts of his several homes and 18 wives. In 1869, though, after President Ulysses S. Grant ramped up federal efforts to catch the guilty parties, Brigham Young grew quite concerned that Lee would be arrested, so he advised his adopted son to sell off his property and make himself scarce. Lee, however, brushed the proposal aside and remained on his old stamping ground, preferring simply to hightail it into the local hills whenever federal agents or bounty hunters approached. During their little jaunt with John Wesley Powell in September 1870, Brigham finally ordered Lee to move far from Washington and Iron counties and establish residency deep in the wilderness. Brigham feared that if Lee were caught, he might spill secrets that could bring down the entire church. According to Juanita Brooks's biography of Lee, during their 1870 excursion onto the Arizona Strip, the prophet told him, "Gather your wives and children around you, select some fertile valley, and settle out here." Conveying a distinct lack of enthusiasm for the suggestion, Lee half-heartedly replied, "Well, if it is your wish and counsel..." "It is my wish and counsel," Brigham impatiently commanded. A month later, for good measure, he excommunicated Lee from the church, eventually exiling him to the upper end of the Grand Canyon to run a shuttle service across the Colorado River. Lee called this forlorn settlement Lonely Dell. Today it's known as Lee's Ferry. In the wake of this turn of fortune, 11 of Lee's wives divorced him, and only 2 of his remaining spouses ever joined him at the desolate outpost that now bears his name. These days, Lee's Ferry serves as the starting point for most float trips down the Grand Canyon. As a consequence, thousands of boaters now pass through John D. Lee's Lonely Dell each year, few of whom ever learn much about the man whose name is attached to the historic settlement. The fact that Lee and the massacre's other prime suspects had gone deep into hiding didn't deter authorities in Washington from their pursuit of justice. To the contrary, the feds only turned up the pressure, making it clear that they would not let the matter rest until the guilty were punished. In November 1874, a U.S. Marshal named William Stokes cornered Lee in the settlement of Panguitch, where he was visiting one of his remaining wives. Stokes discovered the fugitive hiding in a chicken coop under a pile of straw and arrested him. Lee was put on trial in Beaver, Utah, 8 months later, but the jury deadlocked and failed to convict. To the American populace, this outcome was the 19th century equivalent of the 1995 O.J. Simpson verdict. Newspapers from coast to coast expressed rabid outrage, generating a hurricane of anti-Mormon sentiment that did not escape the notice of Brigham and his counselors in Great Salt Lake City. Conceding the inevitable, Brigham adopted a pragmatic new strategy that was as brilliant as it was callous. He stopped claiming that the Indians were responsible for the massacre and decided to blame the whole thing on Lee, offering up his adopted son as a scapegoat. Lee was put on trial a second time in 1876. On this occasion, the LDS First Presidency carefully screened the jurors, all Mormons, to ensure that Lee and Lee alone would be convicted. Jacob Hamblin, who had been far from the Mountain Meadow when the killing took place, proved to be the star witness for the prosecution. His convincing, if perjured, testimony of Lee's savagery sealed the latter's fate. "So carefully had the questions been placed," wrote Juanita Brooks, "so patient and delicate had the lawyers been with the witnesses, that the combined sins of all the 50 men who were present were laid on the shoulders of John D. Lee." On September 20th, after considering the witnesses and evidence that Brigham had very selectively provided to the prosecution, Brigham's jury found Lee guilty of first-degree murder. The court sentenced Lee to die, thereby satisfying Gentile America's demand for justice, or at least the appearance thereof. "Someone had to be sacrificed," one of the jurors admitted afterward, alluding to the passage from the Book of Mormon, in which Nephi slays Laban, the same passage that had inspired Dan Lafferty to kill. "Better for one man to die than for a whole nation to dwindle in unbelief." In prison, awaiting execution, Lee used the time remaining to him to pen his life story, which was published posthumously under the title Mormonism Unveiled, and became a national bestseller. At the conclusion of his book, Lee wrote, "I was guided in all that I did, which is called criminal, by the orders of the leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I have never knowingly disobeyed the orders of the Church since I joined it at Far West, Missouri, until I was deserted by Brigham Young and his slaves." On the morning of March 23, 1877, under the watchful eye of his guards, Lee stepped out of a carriage onto the sandy loam of the Mountain Meadow, the first time he had returned to the site of the massacre in 20 years. The condemned man completed his will, sat down on a coffin that would shortly hold his corpse, and listened to a marshal make a formal recitation of his death warrant. Then he stood and calmly addressed the crowd of some 80 people who had traveled to the meadow to watch him die. "A victim must be had, and I am the victim," Lee declared with a mix of resignation and accusation. "I have been sacrificed in a cowardly, dastardly manner." After Lee finished speaking, the marshal tied a blindfold across his eyes, and Lee sat down again on the edge of the open coffin, imploring of the firing squad, "Let them shoot the balls through my heart. Don't let them mangle my body." A moment later, a deafening blast shattered the peace of the morning and 4 bullets tore into his chest. John D. Lee tipped back from the waist into the wooden box, his feet still planted on the meadow, as the rifle's report echoed from the surrounding hills. Chapter 20. Under the Banner of Heaven. Civil libertarians have consistently insisted on America's sacred duty to make the country a place of unprecedented religious tolerance. Faced, however, with the realities of religious pluralism, multiplying sects and excessive fervor for seemingly bizarre religious tenets, they have reacted with something short of enthusiasm. R. Lawrence Moore, Religious Outsiders and the Making of Americans. In his day, John D. Lee was renowned not only for his role in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, but also as a gifted healer and oracle. He cured many an ailing Mormon by the laying on of hands. Numerous saints were awed by the accuracy of his prophecies, and never more so than on the occasion of his final prediction. According to a family memoir, shortly before Lee was executed, he prophesied, "If I am guilty of the crime for which I am convicted, I will go down and out and never be heard of again. If I am not guilty, Brigham Young will die within 1 year. Yes, within 6 months." On August 23rd, 1877, exactly 5 months after Lee's death, Brigham was overcome with fever, gastrointestinal cramps, diarrhea, and vomiting. 6 days later, the old boss, as Lee called him, was dead, most likely from a ruptured appendix. Brigham had hoped that offering up Lee for sacrifice would appease the Gentile powers in Washington and win the saints at least a modicum of relief from the hounding of federal minions. He was sorely mistaken. From the time Rutherford B. Hayes moved into the Oval Office in 1877 through the end of Grover Cleveland's term in 1897, each successive American president increased pressure on the Mormon Church to forsake polygamy and submit to the laws of the land. John Taylor, who replaced Brigham as the Saints' president, prophet, seer, and revelator, refused to cede an inch to the government in Washington. If anything, he was even less acquiescent than the old boss had been. Taylor had believed passionately in Joseph Smith and his doctrines ever since their first encounter, when Joseph had grasped Taylor's hand and caused an electric current to race up his arm. On that bleak afternoon when Joseph was shot dead in the Carthage jail, Taylor had been within arm's reach of the prophet and had been gravely wounded himself. The truest of true believers, Taylor was not about to compromise the most sacred principles of the kingdom of God to appease the church's Gentile oppressors. "God will lay his hand upon this nation," Taylor proclaimed in 1879. "There will be more bloodshed, more ruin, more devastation than ever they have seen before. We do not want them to force upon us that institution of monogamy called the social evil." A year later, Taylor's recalcitrance and rage had only intensified. "When they enact tyrannical laws forbidding us the free exercise of our religion, we cannot submit," he pronounced on January 4, 1880, during a Sunday assembly in Great Salt Lake City. "God is greater than the United States, and when the government conflicts with heaven, we will be ranged under the banner of heaven and against the government. The United States says we cannot marry more than one wife. God says different. Polygamy is a divine institution. It has been handed down direct from God. The United States cannot abolish it. No nation on earth can prevent it, nor all the nations of the earth combined. These are my sentiments, and all of you who sympathize with me in this position will raise your right hands. I defy the United States. I will obey God." Every right hand in the vast assembly hall instantly shot heavenward. Taylor was a man of the highest integrity who had devoted his life completely to the church. Among the saints, his words held enormous sway. Back in Washington, President Hayes thought little of Taylor's rhetoric. After paying a personal visit to Great Salt Lake City in 1880, Hayes urged Congress to enact laws ensuring that the right to vote, hold office, and sit on juries in the territory of Utah be confined to those who neither practice nor uphold polygamy. Over the next 15 years, Congress obliged him by passing legislation that did exactly that and more. After the Edmonds Act was passed in 1882, Mormons could be prosecuted not only for engaging in polygamy, which was difficult to prove, but also for unlawful cohabitation, which wasn't. Thereafter, Utah's polygamists were derogatorily referred to as cohabs, and swarms of federal agents descended on Utah to carry out cohab hunts in virtually every town in the territory. By the late 1880s, some 1,000 saints had been thrown in jail, but still the Mormons remained defiant. Going to prison on a polygamy conviction became something to brag about. Although they didn't reveal their concern to the brethren, Mormon leaders were nevertheless feeling the heat. John Taylor dispatched increasing numbers of saints not only to far-flung desert settlements around the American West, such as Lee's Ferry, but also to Mexico and Canada in order to establish safe havens where a man could have a plurality of wives without fear of harassment or arrest. Thriving colonies of cohabs sprung up in such places as Cardston, Canada, in the province of Alberta just north of the Montana border, and at the foot of the Sierra Madre Occidental in Mexico. Then in 1885, a warrant went out for Taylor's arrest, forcing the prophet himself to go into hiding. 1 year after that, he thumbed his nose at the feds by marrying 26-year-old Josephine Ruesch, his 16th wife. The groom was 78 years old at the time. The heart of the saints resisted federal control, however, the more Washington resolved to bring them to heel. In March 1887, Congress passed the harshest legislation yet directed at the Mormons, the Edmonds-Tucker Bill. 4 months later, John Taylor died, still in hiding, and a day after he was laid to rest, federal lawyers initiated a series of legal actions intended to bankrupt the Mormon Church. On May 19, 1890, they achieved their desired end when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on these actions against the saints, allowing church holdings to be seized by the government. The whole of Mormondom was wobbling on the brink. With the death of Taylor in 1887, an 82-year-old apostle named Wilford Woodruff had been installed as the fourth Mormon prophet. and he recognized with great pain that the kingdom of God had no choice but to surrender to Washington's demands. After taking to his bed on the evening of September 23, 1890, Woodruff reported, "He struggled all night with the Lord about what should be done with the existing circumstances of the church." In the morning, he called together five trusted Mormon leaders and, with broken spirit, informed them that God had revealed to him the necessity of relinquishing the practice of that principle for which the brethren had been willing to lay down their lives. To the shock and utter horror of the other men in the room, President Woodruff explained that it was the will of the Lord that the church stop sanctioning the doctrine of plural marriage. On October 6, 1890, Woodruff's momentous revelation was formalized in a brief document that became known as the Woodruff Manifesto, or simply, the Manifesto. It read, in part, "Inasmuch as laws have been enacted by Congress forbidding plural marriages, which laws have been pronounced constitutional by the Court of Last Resort, I hereby declare my intention to submit to those laws and to use my influence with the members of the church over which I preside to have them do likewise. And I now publicly declare that my advice to the Latter-day Saints is to refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the law of the land. Wilford Woodruff, President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." The impact of the manifesto shook Mormondom to its roots, but it did not end polygamy. It merely drove it underground. For the next two decades, members of the Mormon First Presidency privately advised saints that polygamy should be continued, albeit discreetly, and top leaders of the church secretly performed numerous plural marriages. When this casuistry came to light, it unleashed a nationwide howl of indignation. In October 1910, the Salt Lake Tribune, which had been established as a rabidly anti-Mormon alternative to the church-owned Deseret News, published the names of some 200 saints who had taken plural wives after the manifesto, including six members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. When the church leadership's deceit about polygamy was made public, it wasn't just Gentiles who were outraged. A number of prominent Mormons were upset as well, sparking a groundswell within the church to enforce the manifesto and eradicate polygamy altogether. By the 1920s, most saints, including their leaders, had turned against polygamy and were encouraging the prosecution of cohabs. A significant number of dedicated saints, however, were convinced that Wilford Woodruff had been grievously mistaken when he'd issued the manifesto, and that heeding it ran counter to the religion's most sacred principles. These hardcore polygamists argued that the manifesto had not revoked Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants, Joseph Smith's 1843 revelation about plural marriage, that it merely suspended the practice under extenuating and presumably temporary circumstances. They pointed out that D&C 132 was still an accepted part of Mormon scripture, as indeed it remains today. These Mormon fundamentalists, as they would proudly call themselves, took special inspiration from a revelation dispensed by the Lord to their departed hero, John Taylor, on September 26, 1886, while he was hiding out from federal cohab hunters. Dan Lafferty is among the modern fundamentalists who still draw inspiration from the third Mormon prophet. "I was favorably impressed with the integrity of John Taylor," Dan says, "and probably at times strengthened in my challenging moments by thinking about him." Perhaps the most contentious revelation in the history of the Mormon Church, it had come in response to a question President Taylor had posed to God, inquiring if his earlier revelation to Joseph concerning the sacred doctrine of plural marriage should be abandoned. God's reply was clear and unambiguous. "Thus saith the Lord, all commandments that I give must be obeyed by those calling themselves by my name, unless they are revoked by me or by my authority. I have not revoked this law, nor will I, for it is everlasting, and those who will enter into my glory must obey the conditions thereof. Even so, amen." At the time he received this revelation, Taylor had been hiding out in the home of a saint named John W. Woolley. During the night, Woolley's son Lauren had noticed an eerie light appearing under the door leading to President Taylor's room, and was at once startled to hear voices of men talking there. There were three distinct voices. At 8 o'clock the next morning, when Taylor emerged from his room, Lauren recalled, "We could scarcely look at him on account of the brightness of his personage." Young Woolley asked Taylor whom he had been talking to in the middle of the night. I have had a very pleasant conversation all night with Brother Joseph, the prophet replied cheerfully, adding that the third voice Lauren had heard was that of Jesus Christ himself. Taylor immediately called a meeting of trusted brethren to discuss his revelation. In addition to Taylor, John W. Woolley, and Lauren C. Woolley, 10 others were in attendance, including Samuel Bateman and his son Daniel R. Bateman. Samuel and Daniel Bateman were Deloy Bateman's great-great-grandfather and great-grandfather, respectively. After sharing what God had revealed to him, Taylor placed all present under covenant that he or she would defend the principle of celestial or plural marriage, and that they would consecrate their lives, liberty, and property to this end, and that they personally would sustain and uphold the principle. The Mormon prophet warned the 12 wide-eyed saints who sat before him, "Some of you will be handled and ostracized and cast out from the church by your brethren because of your faithfulness and integrity to this principle, and some of you may have to surrender your lives because of the same. But woe, woe unto those who shall bring these troubles upon you." Then Taylor called together 5 of the assembled saints, including Samuel Bateman, John W. Woolley, and Lauren C. Woolley, and granted them authority not only to perform celestial marriages, but to ordain others to do the same, thereby seeing to it that no year passed by without children being born in the principle of plural marriage. This historic meeting, the authenticity of which has been angrily disputed by LDS general authorities ever since, lasted 8 hours. As it was winding down, Taylor prophesied that in the time of the 7th president of this church, the church would go into bondage, both temporarily and spiritually, and in that day the one mighty and strong spoken of in the 85th section of the Doctrine and Covenants would come. And thus were the seeds of Mormon fundamentalism sown. 4 years later, when the LDS church voted to sustain the manifesto and end polygamy, Mormon society began to take its first tentative steps toward joining the American mainstream, slowly and ambivalently at first, and then with stunning determination. But the fundamentalists refused to have any part of it. They remain dedicated to the doctrines of Joseph Smith, to his doctrine of plural marriage in particular. They vowed to uphold John Taylor's covenant with ferocious resolve, regardless of the course taken by the rest of Mormondom or the rest of the world. Today that same vow has been taken up by the fundamentalists' 21st century brethren, and their fervor is no less resolute. To Mormon fundamentalists, to the likes of Dan Lafferty and the inhabitants of Colorado City, and Brian David Mitchell, the abductor of Elizabeth Smart, September 27, 1886 is a sacred date. From that moment forward, faithful polygamists have been eagerly anticipating the arrival of the one mighty and strong, who will, as Joseph prophesied, set in order the house of God. Part 4. Both revelation and delusion are attempts at the solution of problems. Artists and scientists realize that no solution is ever final, but that each new creative step points the way to the next artistic or scientific problem. In contrast, those who embrace religious revelations and delusional systems tend to see them as unshakable and permanent. Religious faith is an answer to the problem of life. The majority of mankind want or need some all-embracing belief system which purports to provide an answer to life's mysteries and are not necessarily dismayed by the discovery that their belief system, which they proclaim as the truth, is incompatible with the beliefs of other people. One man's faith is another man's delusion. Whether a belief is considered to be a delusion or not depends partly upon the intensity with which it is defended, and partly upon the numbers of people subscribing to it. Anthony Storr, Feet of Clay. Chapter 21. Evangeline. My mother was born into a world of early 20th century Mormon Utah, a place that, in many respects, was dramatically different from the America that surrounded it. The Mormons had long possessed a strong and spectacular sense of otherness and unity. They saw themselves not only as God's modern chosen people, but also as a people whose faith and identity had been forged by a long and bloody history, and by outright banishment. They were a people apart, a people with its own myths and purposes, and with a history of astonishing violence. Michael Gilmore, shot in the heart. For more than 15 years, ever since Rulon Jeffs became leader of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the inhabitants of Colorado City were sustained by their conviction that he was the one mighty and strong, the Lord's anointed emissary on earth, a prophet whom God had granted eternal life. But Uncle Rulon had been gravely ill for a long time, and on September 8, 2002, his heart stopped beating and a physician pronounced him dead. That was 4 days ago. Now, as the reality of their leader's death has begun to sink in, the town's residents are desperately trying to reconcile their faith in his immortality with the inescapable fact that he is deceased. Today, on a warm and cloudless Thursday afternoon, more than 5,000 people, mostly devout fundamentalists, but a few Gentiles and mainline Mormons as well, have assembled in Colorado City from as far away as Canada and Mexico to pay their respects and bury Uncle Rulon. The men and boys somberly filing out of the funeral service that has just concluded in the Leroy Johnson Meeting House are dressed in their Sunday best. The women and girls wear ankle-length dresses in pastel shades of pink, lavender, and blue that could be straight out of the 19th century. Their hair, pulled back into long, chaste braids, first rises from their foreheads in fabulous crests, painstakingly arranged, that bring to mind breaking surf. Above the grieving throngs, the cliffs of Canaan Mountain glow in the angled sunlight, profiled against a blue autumn sky. Uncle Rulon, who was 3 months shy of his 93rd birthday when he passed on, left behind an estimated 75 bereft wives and at least 65 children. There is much uncertainty about how the next of kin and the rest of his followers will cope in his absence. An air of vague anxiety hangs over the community. The same kind of apprehension gripped Colorado City in 1986, when the prophet who preceded Uncle Rulon, Leroy Johnson, the much-adored Uncle Roy, perished at the age of 98. Uncle Roy was also supposed to live forever. After his death, Uncle Rulon assumed leadership of the sect, but his right to claim Uncle Roy's mantle was furiously contested by those loyal to a prominent bishop named Marion Hammond. Hammond's followers, amounting to nearly a third of the community, left the fold en masse, moved onto a swath of desert just across the highway, and founded their own fundamentalist church, which became known as the Second Ward. The original church was called the First Ward. Each congregation accused the other of being godless apostates and issued impassioned warnings about the eternal damnation that would surely be the other's fate, which is pretty much how things still stand today. Now, following Uncle Rulon's demise, the First Ward is threatened by further rifts, even though 46-year-old Warren Jeffs, the second son of Rulon's fourth wife, moved swiftly to take the reins of the church. Because his father had been seriously ailing for several years, Warren had already been running things and had long functioned as prophet in everything but name. But Warren, a tall, bony man with a bulging Adam's apple, a high-pitched voice, and a frightening sense of his own perfection in the eyes of God, has never received anything remotely close to the kind of affection lavished on Uncle Rulon or Uncle Roy by the people of Colorado City and bountiful British Columbia. Almost nobody in either town refers to Warren Jeffs as Uncle Warren. My father and especially Uncle Roy were warm, loving prophets who taught polygamy for the right reasons, said one of the new prophet's older siblings. Warren has no love for the people. His method for controlling them is to inspire fear and dread. My brother preaches that you must be perfect in your obedience. You must have the Spirit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or you'll be cut off and go to hell. Warren's a fanatic. Everything is black and white to him. A great many First Warders had hoped that an admired 95-year-old patriarch named Fred Jessup, known as Uncle Fred, would succeed Uncle Rulon. When Warren was ordained as prophet instead, there was considerable speculation that Uncle Fred's followers would be sufficiently disenchanted to secede from the First Ward and form yet another sect of their own. But the brother of Warren quoted above speculates that this faction may bide their time for a while before deciding to make the break, because they don't think Warren is going to be sitting in the prophet's chair for long. They're holding on. They believe that it's just a matter of time before God takes this evil man from their midst, leaving the First Ward intact with one of their own in power. And I agree with them. I think Warren's going to get his comeuppance. I don't know how it's going to happen or when, but I think he's going to suffer an untimely death. I feel this in my bones. In the meantime, Warren is still very much in the company of the living, and he has been taking steps to consolidate his power. Up in bountiful British Columbia, he has stripped Winston Blackmore, whom he has long resented and distrusted, of his leadership position and has threatened to banish him from the religion altogether. Warren installed a compliant man named Jimmy Oler, the half-brother of Debbie Palmer, the woman who burned her house down to escape Bountiful, as the new bishop of the Canadian branch of the church. But at least half of the Bountiful community has remained loyal to Blackmore. Should he decide to establish an independent sect of his own, many Canadian fundamentalists would probably sever their ties with Warren's church in Colorado City to follow Blackmore. But schisms of this sort are hardly a new phenomenon. A look backward at the history of Mormon fundamentalism shows that its adherents have been splintering into rival sects ever since the first group of diehard polygamists themselves broke away from the main Mormon church a century ago. The polygamous roots of Colorado City, nay Short Creek, lead back to John D. Lee and the Forlorn Outpost, where he was exiled by Brigham Young after the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Lee's Ferry is situated at a sweeping bend in the Colorado River, immediately below the lowermost rapids of Glen Canyon, and just upstream from where the turbulent river surges into the depths of the Grand Canyon. In the 19th century, because it was the only place for many miles where the torrent could be crossed, this bit of desert was of great strategic importance to the Kingdom of Deseret. Saints traveling between Utah and Mormon colonies in Arizona and Mexico, as well as the occasional Gentile prospector, relied on Lee to shuttle them across the river in his small wooden scow. Prior to his arrest and subsequent execution, operating this ferry service provided Lee with a meager living. When Lee was captured and jailed in 1874, the LDS Church recruited a saint named Warren M. Johnson to resettle with his two wives and children on the north bank of the Colorado River in order to help Lee's wife Emma maintain the crucial crossing. On June 12, 1888, one of Johnson's wives gave birth to a boy at Lee's Ferry. The baby was christened Leroy Sunderland Johnson, but in later years, after he had risen to become prophet of the fundamentalist church, everyone would call him Uncle Roy. After the manifesto, the remoteness of Lee's Ferry was considered especially attractive to polygamists, and it became a haven for cohabs, as did another isolated settlement on the Arizona Strip, Short Creek, founded in 1911. By the early decades of the 20th century, tight bonds had been established between the polygamous inhabitants of Short Creek and Lee's Ferry, a group that included Warren Johnson and his descendants. In 1928, when improved access brought swelling ranks of outsiders through Lee's Ferry, some of the Johnson clan, including Leroy, pulled up stakes and moved to Short Creek, which remained farther off the beaten track and was thus likely to draw the attention of cohab hunters. By the mid-1930s, the fundamentalist movement was being led by a staunch polygamist named John Y. Barlow. Although he lived in northern Utah, when Barlow heard that Short Creek had become a magnet for families devoted to the work, he cultivated a close relationship with the community as a whole, and Leroy Johnson in particular. In 1940, Barlow transplanted some of his own families to Short Creek, and later one of his daughters was married to Johnson. Deloy Bateman happens to be John Y. Barlow's grandson. Another of Barlow's descendants, Dan Barlow, is today the mayor of Colorado City. In the homes of the present-day residents of Colorado City and Bountiful, it is common to see the portraits of eight ecclesiastical leaders hanging on the walls. Usually arranged in a large, handsomely framed montage, the portraits depict the preeminent stars in the constellation of Mormon fundamentalism. Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, John W. Woolley, Lauren C. Woolley, John Y. Barlow, Leroy Johnson, and Rulon Jeffs. Fundamentalists believe the so-called keys to priesthood authority, the divinely ordained power to lead the righteous, have been given to each of these prophets in turn, starting with Joseph and proceeding through Uncle Rulon, and now, with Rulon's death, to Warren Jeffs. This, at any rate, is how the folks in Colorado City and Bountiful view things. Other fundamentalist communities, however, glorify a slightly different pantheon of prophets. After John Y. Barlow died in 1949, the fundamentalist leadership was transferred to a respected acolyte named Joseph Musser, who was immediately stricken by a series of crippling strokes, creating the first major schism in the movement. When he became debilitated, Musser was treated by a folksy, gregarious naturopath and fellow polygamist named Roulon Allred, on whom he became utterly dependent. In 1951, Musser, now gravely ill, appointed Allred his second elder, his heir apparent, over the strenuous objections of those who believed Leroy Johnson should succeed Musser as prophet, as John Y. Barlow had specified before his death. The hatred between Uncle Roy's supporters and the Allred camp was so strong that the fundamentalist movement split into two rival sects. Following Musser's death in 1954, Uncle Roy assumed leadership of the larger splinter group, which remained in Short Creek and called itself the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or simply the United Effort Plan, UEP. Allred became prophet of the other splinter, called the Apostolic United Brethren, which was based 280 miles to the north in the Salt Lake Valley. Roulon Allred's polygamist father, Byron C. Allred, was an eminent Mormon who had been Speaker of the Idaho House of Representatives before, in flight from the Kohab Hunters, relocating to Mexico, where Roulon was born in 1906. Alex Joseph and John Bryant, leaders of independent polygamist communities whom Dan and Ron Lafferty visited in the summer of 1984, shortly before they murdered Brenda and Erica Lafferty, were introduced to Mormon fundamentalism by Roulon Allred. Both Joseph and Bryant, in fact, were devoted followers of Allred before breaking with him and going out on their own. After the split, the Short Creekers had little further involvement with their counterparts in the Allred group. Taking care to fly below the radar of the Gentile culture, Uncle Roy and his followers were seldom noticed by the world beyond Short Creek. The Apostolic United Brethren wasn't so fortunate. On the afternoon of May 10, 1977, Roulon Allred was treating patients in his office in Murray, a suburb of Salt Lake City, when two young women walked in, shot him dead, and calmly walked out. Allred's killers turned out to be members of another breakaway fundamentalist sect known as the LeBaron Clan. Founded by a man named Dayer LeBaron, who hailed from one of the Mormon colonies in Mexico, the sect had once maintained a loose association with Allred's group. After Roulon Allred was convicted of polygamy in Utah in 1947 and jumped parole, the LeBarons even gave him refuge in Mexico for a period. Dayer LeBaron had seven sons. Three of the seven LeBaron brothers would eventually claim at one time or another to be the one mighty and strong. Each regarded himself as a divinely ordained prophet comparable to Moses, who would return the Mormon Church to the righteous path it had abandoned after the 1890 Manifesto. The oldest of the brothers, Benjamin, was fond of roaring at the top of his lungs in public to prove that he was the Lion of Israel. In one legendary incident that occurred in the early 1950s, he lay face down in the middle of a busy Salt Lake City intersection, bringing traffic to a halt, and did 200 push-ups. When the police finally persuaded him to get up off the pavement, he proudly insisted, "Nobody else can do that many. That proves I'm the one mighty and strong." Not long thereafter, Ben was committed to the Utah State Mental Hospital. In the 1960s, with Ben locked up in a psychiatric institution, two of the other LeBaron brothers emerged as the group's guiding lights. Soft-spoken, amiable Joel and tightly wound Ervil, who weighed 240 pounds, stood 6 feet 4 inches tall and knew how to nurse a grudge. A dashing figure, he was found irresistibly attractive by many otherwise sensible women. Another LeBaron sibling, Alma, reported that Ervil used to dream about having 25 or 30 wives so he could multiply and replenish the earth. He wanted to be like Brigham Young, a great man. Ervil also fancied himself a brilliant writer and scriptorian. According to Rena Chenoweth, who would become his 13th wife in 1975 and 2 years later pull the trigger of the gun that killed Roulon Allred, Ervil would write scripture obsessively in marathon sessions that might last for a week or more. He would go for days without shaving or bathing, putting in 20 hours a day, she recalled, sustaining himself on continuous cups of coffee. When he sweated, that was all you could smell coming out of his pores. Coffee. Chenoweth went to great lengths to conceal her involvement in Allred's murder. Although she was charged with the crime in 1978, she lied under oath at trial and thereby beat the rap. 12 years later, she wrote a breezy tell-all memoir about the LeBarons titled The Blood Covenant, the source of these quotes, in which she revealed her culpability. When the book was published in 1990, Allred survivors filed a civil action against Chenoweth and won a $52 million wrongful death judgment against her. Both Ervil and Joel were imbued with exceptional charisma, and both claimed to be the One Mighty and Strong. It was therefore inevitable, perhaps, that the LeBaron brothers would eventually clash. The terminal rupture began in November 1969 when Joel, the elder brother and nominal presiding prophet, booted Ervil out of the sect for insubordination. Soon thereafter, Ervil had a revelation in which God explained that Joel, by all accounts an uncommonly benevolent man, routinely described by his followers as saint-like, had become an obstacle to his work and needed to be removed. On August 20, 1972, in the polygamist settlement of Los Molinos, which Joel had established 8 years earlier on the Baja Peninsula, was shot in the throat and head, fatally, by a member of the group loyal to Ervil. Los Molinos was also where, in 1986, 13-year-old Linda Coons married 37-year-old Tom Green, the Utah polygamist convicted in 2001 after boasting of his polygamous lifestyle on Dateline NBC. After he ordered the death of Joel, Ervil initiated a divinely inspired series of murders, resulting in the killing of at least 5 additional people through 1975 and the wounding of more than 15 others. In March 1976, he was arrested for these crimes and held in a Mexican jail, but Ervil's followers on the outside continued to do his bidding. Operating out of a post office box in Southern California, they distributed pamphlets denouncing taxes, welfare, gun control, and rival polygamists. When Jimmy Carter ran for president in 1976, Ervil's subordinates even issued a decree threatening the candidate with death for his liberal views. Less than a year after he was incarcerated, Ervil was let out of jail. The official explanation was a lack of evidence, although everyone assumed that well-placed bribes had more to do with it. Within a few months of his release, he had a disobedient daughter killed, and shortly after that, arranged the murder of Rulon Allred, whose followers Ervil coveted and hoped to convert to his own group, the Church of the Lamb of God. Ervil managed to remain a free man until 1979, when he was finally arrested in Mexico. He was extradited to the United States, convicted and sentenced to life behind bars in the Utah State Prison at Point of the Mountain, in the same maximum security facility where Dan Lafferty now resides. By 1981, as he began to understand that his prospects for ever getting out of the penitentiary were nil, Ervil became increasingly frantic and irrational. According to Rena Chenoweth, he began having revelations of a miracle that would free him. He envisioned God's wrath striking down the prison walls like the walls of ancient Jericho because the pagan temporal authorities dared to incarcerate God's chosen prophet and revelator. In August 1981, Ervil LeBaron was discovered dead in his cell at the age of 56, felled by an apparent heart attack. Before succumbing, however, he had written a rambling 400-page screed, oozing venom from every line, titled The Book of the New Covenants. The text was primarily a list of all those individuals who, in Ervil's view, had ever been disloyal to him and thus deserved to die. This catalog of hatred was accompanied by scathing, semi-coherent descriptions of the precise nature of each betrayal. Essentially, the book was an overwrought hit list. Some 20 copies were published, most of which wound up in the possession of Ervil's most devoted followers. These fervent lambs of God, as they called themselves, were largely drawn from among Ervil's 54 children, progeny who remained fanatically devoted to their father long after his death. Led by a son named Aaron LeBaron, who was just 13 when Ervil died, this gang of boys, girls, and young adults, most of whom had been physically and or sexually abused by older members of the sect and then abandoned, resolved to avenge Ervil's death by systematically spilling the blood of the persons listed in the Book of the New Covenants. A prosecutor assigned to the case referred to this pack of parentless kids as the LeBaron clan's Lord of the Flies generation. 2 men on the hit list were assassinated in 1987. Then on June 27, 1988, the 144th anniversary of Joseph Smith's martyrdom, 3 more people on the list, along with the 8-year-old daughter of one of them, were ambushed and gunned down. These latter four murders, which occurred within 5 minutes of one another at different sites in Texas 300 miles apart, were carefully planned to occur at almost the exact hour that Joseph was fatally shot in the Carthage jail. Afterward, the Lambs of God bragged that they were responsible for the deaths of 17 people, all told. Because each of their victims had been killed as an act of blood atonement, the Lambs explained, the exterminations were justified in the eyes of the Lord. In 1993, two of Ervil's sons and one of his daughters were sentenced to life in prison for their involvement in some of these crimes. 2 years after that, Aaron LeBaron, the mastermind of the gang, was captured in Mexico, extradited to Utah, and in 1997 sentenced to 45 years in prison. The whereabouts of several other LeBaron offspring who played lesser roles in the murders remain unknown. The Mormon presence in Mexico, which remains strong even today, goes back to 1886, when a group of polygamous saints purchased 50,000 acres along the Rio Piedras Verdes, about 150 miles southwest of El Paso, Texas, to escape the Kohab hunts then sweeping Utah. By the time the first of the LeBarons moved south of the border in 1902, 3,500 Mormons were already residing in the vicinity of this settlement at the foot of the Sierra Madre Occidental, which was called Colonia Juarez. In 1944, Dayer LeBaron, father to Joel and Ervil, received a revelation in which God commanded him to buy a piece of mesquite-covered desert about 35 miles outside of Colonia Juarez. He cleared the land, planted a crop of beans, and christened the place Colonia LeBaron. It was soon the base of operations for Dayer's expanding fundamentalist sect. A cute teenager named Levina Stubbs moved to Colonia LeBaron in 1958 after spending the first 15 years of her life in Short Creek. The Stubbs family name was and still is one of the most prestigious pedigrees in Short Creek / Colorado City, but Levina's father had a falling out with Uncle Roy, converted to the LeBaron group, and moved his brood to Mexico. A year later, at the tender age of 16, having caught the eye of Prophet Joel LeBaron, Levina became one of his plural wives. "I was married to Joel for 14 joyful years," Levina says. "He was an absolutely righteous man, one of the greatest men that ever lived." Before moving away from Short Creek, Levina's mother had wanted her to marry Deloy Bateman's father, but the prophet commanded her to become the plural wife of someone else, whom she despised. "I was almost forced to marry a man there who I couldn't stand," she recalls. "I got out by the skin of my teeth. It was a miracle that my father took us away when he did, and God allowed me to marry Joel instead." In 1972, however, Joel was shot dead on Ervil's orders, and Levina's life entered an extended rough stretch, from which it has yet to emerge. The worst of her heartache she attributes to Kenyon Blackmore, first cousin of Winston Blackmore, the erstwhile leader of the polygamist community in Bountiful, British Columbia. In 1983, Kenyon Blackmore married Joel and Levina LeBaron's 22-year-old daughter, Gwendolyn. The marriage not only brought out the worst in both partners, but it has injected misery into the life of almost every person it has touched. Among these unlucky souls is a Canadian woman named Annie Vandeveer Blackmore. When Kenyon Blackmore wed young Gwendolyn LeBaron, he was already married to Annie. At that point, in fact, Annie had been married to Kenyon for 24 years, yet he neglected to tell her that he had taken a second wife. "See that picture on the wall?" Annie asks with a sour smile, pointing to a framed cover of the September 29, 1956 issue of Canada's Weekend magazine, depicting a pair of beautiful 17-year-old cowgirls astride equally magnificent horses. "That was how I met Ken." The two cowgirls are Annie and her twin sister, photographed on their family's ranch outside Winnipeg, Manitoba. Upon seeing this magazine cover, 20-year-old Kenyon Blackmore, an avid horseman from a family of renowned polygamists in Western Canada, resolved on the spot to marry at least one of the lovely twins. "When he come across this article," Annie says, "he started to write us letters and became my pen pal. He was about to go on a mission to South Africa, but he wrote to me the whole time he was gone. And when he got home 2 years later, he took a trip out to Winnipeg to see us. 6 months later, in December 1959, Ken and me were married." Exactly 9 months after that, Annie gave birth to a baby girl, Lena, the first of seven children she would have with Kenyon, and they moved to Provo so he could attend Brigham Young University. In 1966, Kenyon took a teaching job in Bountiful. And there, as Annie phrases it, he started pushing for marrying plural wives. Before we'd gotten married, he'd told me about his polygamist relatives, but it didn't mean anything to me at the time. I'd only converted to Mormonism after meeting Ken. I didn't know much about polygamy or anything. I was just a farmer's daughter, a country girl from Manitoba. Annie tried to approach the idea with an open mind. I was raised to be a peacemaker, she says. My whole life I tried to please him, to do whatever he wanted. But I just couldn't accept plural marriage.